It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Hey guys, Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. You might have heard the podcast we did a couple months ago for Star Trek The Celebration. It was an event at DePaul University, and I was invited to be on a panel with other really interesting people. One of those people was Walter J. Podrajic. We got to talking on the day, and he let me know that his museum, the Museum of Broadcast Communications, was doing an exhibit on television in the 90s. I was immediately interested because being Generation X, I watched pretty much everything that was on television in the 90s. So Steven and I went to the museum. It was fantastic. Walter walked us through the exhibit himself. We went to one of the radio studios that they have inside the building, and we did a podcast. And what follows now is not only a discussion of television in the 90s and Walter's work with the museum, but also we get into his book, Watching TV, which is a book he wrote with Harry Castleman. This is the third edition. The first one was written in the 80s. So it's become his life's work where every couple of decades they go back and add to this ongoing history of television. It's a really interesting discussion, so let's just get to it.
I'm television curator here at the Museum of Broadcast Communication in Chicago.
That was beautiful. I couldn't do that.
That is fantastic.
I wasn't going to do that that well. But we're here. This is the first time I've been here, and we were discussing before. I used to work at the Museum of Television and Radio. And I used to live near the Museum of the Moving Image in New York. So this museum feels like a combination of the two in some ways.
And to explain what you mean by that, because we were discussing that, is I've been to both of those places, and there's a heavy emphasis on exhibitry at the Museum of Moving Image and a heavy emphasis on archival material at what is now called the Paley Center.
Right.
And here we have both. And in particular, we're very proud of the exhibit that we have now, the exhibits we have now, because we have multiple exhibits, some newly set up and some been here for a while. As we were walking through, I was showing you the Watching TV in the 1990s,
right,
which just opened this month. And that looks at television in the 1990s.
Yeah, which is really fascinating. I'm a Gen Xer, so I really came of age in the 90s. So it's when I go back to the 80s, television was just something that happened around me because I was too young.
Yeah.
But the 90s was when I really went deeply into it. So I was really interested to see in which ways you covered things. So looking through the exhibit, what would you say was the most important change in the 90s in television from the 80s to the 2000s? What was the real linchpin?
The real linchpin about the 90s is that it's the last decade in which everyone, when talking about television, was talking about watching television on a television set.
Yeah, because that's
at the same time.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Right.
It was all going to change in the 21st century. And there were threads and hints of it already in the 90s.
Sure.
But essentially, when we talked about the shared experience, that was the means of sharing the experience. Mm-hmm. And that sort of became the thematic starting point as we started to gather the information, as I started to try to decide which are the shows that we're going to emphasize, what are the moments that we want to capture. Because there's still this awareness of television, super awareness of television with historical perspective that users, viewers, and producers would have. So there's a lot of self-referential, either deliberate or just unconscious, automatic. So this is the decade that introduced The Simpsons.
Right.
This is the decade that introduced Seinfeld. This is the decade that introduced Friends. This is the decade that introduced The Larry Sanders Show.
Yeah.
And all of those are very consciously aware of everything that came before them, either explicitly or just by the way that they're playing the jokes. Now, The Simpsons is most obvious because they allude to everything.
Right.
But Seinfeld is a perfect example of, no, we're not like the sitcoms that you are familiar with. No, it's about nothing.
Right.
Now, in effect, it was about a lot. It was very intricately written and superbly executed. But in effect, it was saying, just what you thought would happen is not going to happen because we're not going there.
Mm-hmm.
There's the... Once you get in a Seinfeld group, which seems to be everyone from that generation and beyond.
Yeah.
I was with my brother-in-law for Father's Day a few weeks ago, and within 3 minutes, there were three Seinfeld references.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, one that I had a great affection for was the proud new parents saying, come and look at the baby.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
Of course, the Seinfeld characters are going, oh, do we have to? I mean, there's just this, they are saying what you imagine the 1950s and the 1960s and the 1970s characters would have said if they had had the opportunity.
Right.
And I mentioned Friends. Friends, it's a throwaway line, but they're on TV, they're watching apparently an episode of Three's Company. And so I believe it was Chandler who walks by and says, oh, yeah, that's the episode with the silly misunderstanding. I mean, obviously, that's every episode
right.
of Three's Company and, in fact, every episode of so many sitcoms that preceded them in TV history. So in the 90s, what you had were people who were performing and viewing who were aware, as I said, of everything that came before and were having fun with it. And that's just on the comedy level.
Yeah, I would even throw Conan O'Brien in there on the show level. He was absolutely riffing with the form in a cartoon. In the way that Letterman had pushed the envelope a little bit, Conan kind of took what Letterman pushed and spun it. So I agree. I think there was definitely a conscious effort to follow the history and do things that had been done before but play with them. And it seems like once you get to the 2000s, then that form is just broken between story arcs that last a season and digital video and shooting things like documentaries and, of course, the rise of reality. It seems like the 90s is the last time that form of storytelling in television was completely intact.
And also in the 90s kept, for instance, reality in check and yet gave us the template that we're still living with,
mm-hmm.
namely the O.J. Simpson trial.
Yeah.
The O.J. Simpson story, the O.J. Simpson saga.
Which this year became a scripted television series.
Exactly.
Right, which is kind of backwards and crazy, but it's, I guess that's what's so interesting is like the late or the last decade of the last millennium or whatever you call it. They were able to play with and break all these rules about what had come before. And like you said, reference all the stuff came before. And it was the last shot at doing that before YouTube and streaming and all this other mm-hmm. stuff. Kind of like I have a TV. I don't watch television. I watch Netflix. You know, I never turn on the TV and watch whatever's physically on
right.
live anymore. It just doesn't happen, you know.
Right. And if somebody recommends something, you go to YouTube.
Right.
To see
yeah.
just, if you're just looking for a scene or a clip of something.
Right.
And that didn't exist. We were just discussing before the show how the Museum of Television Radio, now the Paley Center, used to had a library, I believe they still do, but they had a library where they would load tapes in the basement for you to watch. And there was talk at the time of like, we should go digital, but nobody knew how to do it.
Yeah.
Because when I was there, it was still 6 years before YouTube.
That's wild.
But.
And so we're very proud of, we have our own museum.tv website, which we have samples mm-hmm. from the collection there. You can make arrangements if you're doing archival research and such to come and tap some of the materials that we have in our collection. And we have a number of unique items in our approach to collecting. For instance, we have recorded since the late 80s at least one local newscast every night.
Wow.
Meaning that has captured history in a way that is not being judgmental after the fact.
Right.
It's like,
yeah.
we're recording this. This is what happened today. We're not saying this is the important story or that's the important story.
There's no hindsight.
There's no hindsight. It's like, this is what happened.
It's every day.
And it's that cumulative resource that makes it such an amazing offering here. So if you came down and made a request for researching, for instance, I was doing some research on the 1988 political conventions, mm-hmm. The Democratic Convention in particular. And I had worked the Democratic Convention in 1988. I had been part of the team there. And you get a distorted view of a convention if you're working there because you're looking at the network pool feed coming through on all the monitors and you're seeing the gavel-to-gavel coverage and all. That's not how people saw it. People saw it basically through the local news coverage. Mm-hmm. What did the local news decide was the important story that they were sharing with the people who are not glued to their TVs and following gavel to gavel? And in that particular year, it was the Reverend Jesse Jackson and Michael Dukakis who were vying for the nomination. And that story played out in the week before the opening gavel, which you can follow on the local news coverage as they make their arrangements, they make their agreements, and Reverend Jackson and his team takes the long bus ride down from Illinois to Atlanta, Georgia. And all of that is something that is captured in an appreciation for local news. Another thing that, of course, I am very proud of here at the Museum of Broadcast Communication is the displays. Now, we talked a little bit, and we'll talk in a little bit more detail about watching TV in the 1990s, but we also have a display on ad icons, 10 key mm-hmm. ad icons. We have children's television, Chicago-based children's television artifacts, puppets, original puppets and such on display from BJ and Dirty Dragon, Garfield Goose. There's also, we have a traveling exhibit on display of Johnny Carson.
That was fascinating.
And you get to see, for instance, the script and then the cue cards and then Johnny delivering the script. Mm. Now, you can go to the cue cards yourself and practice your Johnny Carson imitation and see if you can pull that off.
That's really neat. Yeah, I guess it's interesting because you know it's obviously scripted. You know it's on cue cards. But then to see it kind of just like laid out, I don't know, it's just a really interesting exhibit. The one thing that's in there is that funny hat.
Karnak's reproduction.
Yeah,
the original was with a private collector.
The photograph, I know the photograph, right? It's like one of those famous photographs you see, but I have no context for what that is.
Yeah.
All I know is, oh, that's like an olden time photograph. Do you know what I mean? It's like to a millennial, that's all that photograph is.
Yeah,
it's
a recurring bit where he was like a prognosticator. He was like a psychic.
Yeah.
And he would hold the envelope up to his head, and he would read the punchline, and then he would open the envelope, and he would read the setup.
Yeah.
So it was always backwards, and Ed McMahon would always repeat the punchline.
and Ed McMahon himself become the punchline as Carson's character.
Yeah, but everything, he was always just like a duck, a lake, and a Ford motor vehicle. And then you'd always hear Ed go, a duck, a lake. And I'm like, wow, Johnny's opening the envelope just to kill the time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I'm glad you're here for, Stephen, because as a millennial, what are your memories of television in the 90s? Because as I mentioned, in the 80s, it was something that was just kind of around me, but I wasn't aware of it. How you saw the 90s?
Yeah, I think mostly, because I'd say, actually, probably more so for me, because I kind of live in a cultural vacuum, but I do think...
We're still trying to get you to watch Seinfeld and Star Trek.
I'm working on it. particularly, television was definitely like, O.J. Simpson's a good example. Now, mm-hmm. that's like... probably the birth of reality TV, right?
Yes,
way people watch that unfold, in hindsight now I can realize what was happening. As a kid, I remember seeing the Bronco on the freeway, and I remember seeing pictures of OJ everywhere and being like, oh, that guy murdered somebody and it's a big trial that everyone's obsessed with. I never watched it regularly. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know what year that was.
You were not obsessed.
Right, yeah, it had nothing to do with me. I was interested in watching, like, Power Rangers and the X-Men cartoons, so it wasn't on my radar at all.
Which we can get into all of that, because that's all very 90s.
It is very 90s, but I think that's, I guess, where, like you said, I've heard you describe it like that, but I think that's a good way of describing it for me, is that it was something that was happening around me. You turn on the TV, oh, it's The Simpsons mm-hmm. are on. It wasn't something that I wasn't as aware of what was happening other than it was happening.
Yeah, it's interesting. The way you talk about the OJ trial is the way I remember the death of John Lennon.
Oh, yeah?
Because I think it's just that, it was just something that happened around, and I remember at the time I thought he was the manager of the Beatles. I didn't know which I was about 8 years old, so I didn't know. I knew who the Beatles were, but I didn't know who they were as individuals.
Yeah.
And then it's later that you realize, oh, this was a major thing that I kind of skated around.
Yeah, it's kind of weird to think that, oh, that's a thing that I lived through the O.J. Simpson trial, but have very little memories of it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like my parents weren't really watching it. They don't really care about whatever's going on in like the zeitgeist or whatever. It's like my dad just worked his like 9 to 5 and ate chicken. You know, he didn't care about like what O.J. Simpson was doing. But it's like the whole thing. It's like then I'll go back and I'll read comic books from like the 80s, and there will be an ad with O.J. Simpson. And to me, he's a murderer. But to people before that, he was like an athlete. He was a football player, and he was like a famous.
He was a commercial spokesman.
Yeah, he was like this guy.
He was an airplane.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I'll watch Airplane. I'm like, that guy looks like O.J. Simpson. Yeah. It's like, no, that guy is O.J. Simpson. And that's
he
the
was
thing
in
that
the Naked Gun movies.
Naked Gun, yeah.
Yeah, it's just it's really interesting, I guess, like, being in that weird, like, lineup of when it happened. And to me, he was a murderer first. And then all this other stuff.
One of the challenges of storytelling that the exhibit presented was, how do we tell the story? And you're a perfect example of giving enough information so that when you read the panels or you follow the timeline or you look at the artifacts, that it begins to tie things together or at least raises questions. It says, I want to know more about this. Yeah. I'd like to hear a discussion. I'd like to see a video. I'd like to just know where this comes from. And what I've discovered as a writer is simply telling and explaining history is what your calling is. You don't have to go off the deep end at all. Just go in and make it understandable.
Right.
The watching TV in the 1990s gave me the opportunity to do that for an entire decade. So that someone starting in 1990 and reading everything there and seeing all the exhibits comes to 1999 and say, I think I've gotten a better sense of what that era was like.
Yeah.
And I've had people come and say, you know, I just was not familiar with it at all. And this did touch my memories that I didn't even realize I had.
Yeah, it's really interesting because it's kind of like a time capsule for the 1990s. When you look at the TV and you guys have all the big events that happen in the news and the impeachment and all this stuff, it is kind of like this working time capsule of, like, here's all the significant cultural things that happened in America and in the world in this decade. It's really kind of interesting, you know, and it's like, it just, the more you pick at it and the more you know now, the weirder it gets. Like, somebody had explained to me the Kardashians. This is like a cultural vacuum. I know who they are, obviously. But the Kardashians' father was like O.J. Simpson's lawyer. And that like blows my mind.
That's what put them in the spotlight.
That's what put them in the spotlight.
In that recent series, they wrote the Kardashians in more just because they're so famous now.
And that's just like fries my brain that's like a connection.
But that's also really interesting about the exhibit, as you were saying, Wally, about you're framing the story of the era, but it's interesting how that story changes from the era you're looking in. Because as we were looking at the exhibits outside, the two things that hit me, first of all, we were looking at the political display, and there was an invite to the inauguration that had Bill Clinton and Hillary from his second term. And now that Hillary's running for president, how that colors some of the political ads that are there. There's a pin that says, you know,
I want Bill Clinton again.
Yeah.
I want Clinton again.
The other thing, when you were mentioning O.J. Simpson, seeing him in comic books and thinking, well, that's a murderer, there in the Simpsons display, there's a cover of Bart Simpson and Bill Cosby, and I had a very different reaction than I would have had 3 years ago.
Right.
Like, I would have thought, oh, yeah, Bill Cosby is a comedy genius, and he had this big show,
90s,
and they put the Simpsons on against the Cosby Show to see how well it would do, and it did okay. The Cosby Show beat it, but then once the Cosby Show went away, it moved back to Sunday.
Right.
But the reaction I had was not the reaction I was supposed to have when that cover was produced.
Right, yeah. So it's like the hindsight totally flips everything. You know, like what blows my mind, probably the craziest thing that I think that you guys have, because I didn't know it was a thing they did. You have a ticket for the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Oh, that was a congressional gallery pass for the press for the sessions that were held on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
I realized that those were almost the quintessential television event in that there were not really any witnesses in all testifying. It was all playing back video and reading transcripts and whatever as they went through almost a predetermined, toward a predetermined outcome, which was he was not going to be found, he was not going to be penalized because you needed to reach a certain number of votes in the Senate. This was for the Senate.
Yeah.
And they weren't going to reach him. So it was almost another dose of a reality show just playing out. But as we tried to get artifacts that are appropriate to the era, there are admissions to the political conventions. There's that ticket to the Capitol Hill hearing, trial, discussion, however you want to describe
what
it at that point.
Yeah.
And all of that is to say, yes, this really happened, but we're looking at it in hindsight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you were asking about the 90s.
Right.
What is the draw there? This was, thematically, we're talking about, we're confidently self-indulgent in the 90s. We really, I mean, this is where Shark Week really took off.
Yeah.
This is where the O.J. Simpson trial, which, because it was televised, became a major touchstone in American pop culture. And people had serious, intense discussions about things like that.
Yeah.
And the shorthand I sometimes offer as to how were the 90s different from what came next is this is all pre-September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially, we know how this works. We know how the pop culture works. We're producers, performers, viewers of television in the 90s. And we got this. We got this. We know. We sort of know what's around the next corner. And if we don't, it's going to be silly anyway. You mentioned Conan O'Brien taking David Letterman to the next step. I mean, David Letterman in the 1990s moves up an hour.
Right.
And he becomes
and changes the network.
And changes networks so that he is saying, all right, I had all those years in the late, late slot. Now I'm moving up right against the Tonight Show slot, which Jay Leno got from NBC. Well, I'm going to take him on directly.
Yeah.
And for a while, David Letterman was beating Leno, and the turnaround event appropriate for the indulgent 1990s was Jay Leno and his Hugh Grant interview, which Hugh Grant was an actor who had been caught in an embarrassing position in Hollywood.
Okay.
And he basically came clean and said, I'm sorry. It was embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so he did that on Jay Leno on The Tonight Show. And this was the era in which, okay, we will get ourselves all worked up or just interested as voyeurs as someone goes on camera and apologizes.
Yeah.
And he was basically doing a image rehab tour when he appeared on Leno and other shows. But that was the type of thing that seemed so newsworthy.
Yeah.
Back then.
And now with the internet, that's become our daily cycle of outrage and remission and apology and then outrage about
it's
something
like
else.
You can really kind of see like the initial spark of like what would become this like crazy outrage over like, who cares what that guy did? That's not, you know, I know who Hugh Grant is. I don't know whatever scandal, I don't remember, but it's like,
he had a prostitute in his car.
But it's like,
you said that more directly than I did.
But it's like,
I felt like he needed it.
He's not the only dude in Hollywood that's done that. He's just one of the few dudes to get caught. And it's like, who cares what he's doing?
Yeah.
It's just like, who cares? But it's like, that's the
But it was also at a critical time for him because he had just crossed over into America. Like, he'd become very big in England with Four Weddings and a Funeral, and then he had this film, 9 Months, which ended up not being very big, but it was like his first Hollywood movie with Julianne Moore, and he was kind of poised to be where Benedict Cumberbatch is right now.
Right.
Of like, we're going to take this guy from England and make him the biggest star. And that punched the air right out of his career.
Yeah, because I don't know the last time I saw him in anything, you know?
I'm trying to think. I feel like I saw him in something, but I couldn't even pinpoint what it was. Yeah.
But for a while, you couldn't turn around and not see him.
Right, and then happened right then.
Yeah.
And he was also dating Elizabeth Hurley, who is in the first Austin Powers.
Yeah, I remember her.
And she was one of the most beautiful women in the world. The prostitute was not one of the most beautiful women in the world.
Right.
And that became part of the news cycle.
Part of the narrative. Yeah, it's so crazy. It's just... I don't know. Yeah, it's definitely a weird time. A weirder time than I think I gave it credit for, you know?
And that, again, is part of the draw as a historian for looking back at that decade and trying to use it as, I don't want to say teachable moment, but it's a series of teachable moments, is to see, oh, this is how we got to be where we are now.
Yeah.
And you're right, before we have the explosion of access to anything, anytime, anywhere, in any form whatsoever, it was still controlled. It was still... Now, this was already in dramatic contrast to, say, if you were a child of the 50s or 60s, in which if you missed something on television, you would hope to heaven that it was scheduled for a rerun sometime in your lifetime.
Yeah, me and John talked about this a few weeks ago. It blows my mind that you guys would go to see, like, Star Wars and in the theater, and then that was it. Is that you couldn't see Star Wars again.
Unless you went back to the theater.
Right, yeah. But then once it was out of theaters, that was it.
But
right?
It would run for a year. I was just talking with my wife last night. We put on Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I was saying how it's my favorite movie ever made. And I was saying how I didn't see it for 8 months. Like, I begged my parents to take me to it for 8 months, and they did. It was still in the theater.
Right.
Because videotape was just starting to happen, but it wasn't that big a deal yet.
Yeah.
It's when video really took over and it became the second avenue for films.
Yeah.
That's when the theater window got really brief.
Right, yeah. It's only a couple months instead of a full year now. It's stuff like the moon landing. It's like you saw that happen live. And that was it.
And
you didn't see it again for how long before...
I mean, you gave an example, though, of something that was a news event. So that might turn up on some kind of documentary special end-of-the-year retrospective, but not at your beck and call.
Right, yeah.
It was someone else had to say, oh, you want to see this? All right. Tune in December 31st for the highlights of the space program.
Yeah.
And you'll be able to see it then. And the idea of being able to see anything, anytime, anywhere had not yet taken hold. Now, we were dealing with, in the 1990s, already we had established that there were alternatives to the broadcast networks of ABC, CBS, and NBC. Fox had just in the 80s entered into the mix. So now you had four over-the-air broadcast networks. During the 90s, we added two more, UPN and the WB. So now you had six broadcast commercial networks. You had public television there. And you had cable in the mix as well. Sounds like a lot if you were comparing it to 1960 versus the 1990s. Comparing the 1990s to now, it's like, oh, that's all you had?
Mm-hmm. Right.
In fact, someone was really excited back in the day saying, and there's this thing, this recorder that will record digitally. TiVo is just around the corner and all. And I said, look, I'm impressed, but I'll be a lot more impressed if it could record something that I missed after the fact.
Oh,
that is to say, I can record something that's coming up. It's no big deal. I could do that with videotape.
Right.
But give me the means to go back and capture what I missed, and I'll be impressed.
Yeah.
Took a while, but that's what we have.
Essentially where we
are. I mean,
now.
Right now, if you all talked about, did you see whatever you want to talk about? Odds are the first thing you're going to do is go to a computer or your phone and say, oh, there it is. Let me see the 1 minute, 2 minutes of that event. And okay, I've now seen it. That was not an option in the 1990s.
Yeah.
You could get access to videotape. You could. That was the decade in which they were experimenting with laser discs, which were not quite the same as DVDs. They were just large discs the size of a 12-inch vinyl album, and that would have like one show on it.
Yeah.
And that was the high-tech means that was a step above video quality of a videotape. But it wasn't until towards the end of the decade that DVDs began to emerge. And we have on display sort of a comparison. We have the box of the VHS tape of The Matrix right next to the DVD of The Matrix.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's your opening.
Right. And there were no – DVD was so big even before digital because – I remember the X-Files, which is a huge 90s show, which we could probably talk about for 20 minutes, was the first show I had seen. It was either the X-Files or 24 that did a season box set. Before then, I got into the X-Files a little late when the first film came out, so around 98. And I fell in love with it, and I wanted to see every episode, and it took me years.
Yeah.
But there were episodes I didn't see until I had that box set because they didn't rerun them in order.
Right.
You know, I would tape every rerun, and they would, and it was a popular show, so they would show it like late night and repeat it. But there were years, or shows like Star Trek. I didn't see, there were whole half seasons of Deep Space Nine that I didn't see because it was syndicated and it was on Monday. Well, now it's on Wednesday and nobody told me.
Yeah.
And it would take years to see a show that was still in syndication. You couldn't pull the discs out, and you certainly couldn't go to it, Netflix, and push a button and just, now you can just start on the first episode and it'll just go.
Yeah. It's like TV Guide. You used to have to get TV Guide to look up when the show was going to be. Now it's like, just check the website. You know, it's like, does TV Guide even exist anymore?
Yes, TV Guide does exist, but because there's so much on television, they cannot capture what they used to capture.
Yeah.
There used to be, I believe it was something like 256 different editions of TV Guide because it was a combination of national and local publication. There were national articles that everyone saw.
Yeah.
And then in the schedule grids, it would be your city, your neighborhood schedule grid. And for a researcher, that is wonderful because they were giving you the, oh, at 11:30 on Wednesday night, there's a rerun of, there's an off-network rerun of this show, and they have the title of the episode, or they have what it was that followed it locally in Chicago. Oh, is that where this obscure show, that's where I first saw it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
There's like, I think there may be two editions, East and West Coast, something like that. But they cannot go into that detail about your local stations because there's just
too much
to try to capture. But that whole sense of it was containable. You could theoretically catch at least one episode of every new series that came out. You'd have to work at it, mm-hmm. but you could. Now, that's hopeless.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even watch premieres of shows anymore. I wait. Sometimes I'll wait a season. And unless I'm pre-sold into it, unless it's someone is doing this show that I already like from something else.
Right.
You know, like when Marin started, I love his podcast. I'm going to watch a show. But mostly, I wait the season and I gather enough reviews of something.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing at this point. It's like, all right, the first season of The Flash is out. So many people said they liked The Flash. It's on Netflix. All right, I guess I'll check it out.
And yeah, now
there's like no effort made on my end to seek out a show if it's not just readily accessible at, like, the touch of a button,
yeah.
You know?
And the 90s was a time where, as I said, there were no season sets. There was no way to keep it. I just ran stacks of videotapes for every show I wanted to keep. Every Sunday night, I was in front of my television with my finger on the pause button for the record, watching The Simpsons and taking out the commercials. On Saturday mornings, Fox's lineup on Saturday mornings, I used to have four tapes. And if it was at my girlfriend's apartment that weekend, I would have to bring the tapes with me.
Yeah.
Because I'd have to switch from Batman to X-Men to Spider-Man to The Tick.
Right.
All shows I have now kept on DVD.
Yeah.
But that it was like a project.
It was like you were keeping your own personal archive because you couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it didn't exist. So as far as archiving goes, and you've worked at the museum where they have an archive, and obviously you've done a lot of archiving, you've guys switched everything over to digital, right?
It's a long process. And here's a very important thing to remember. It's a labor-intensive process.
Yeah.
And even after you've finished doing the digital transfer, don't get rid of the original tape. because who knows what technology changes will take place in the next couple of years. So you want to be able to go back to whatever your original source is and bring it up.
Because you don't want like a copy of a copy.
Exactly. Right. No matter what they say, digital, you can't tell. Yes, you can.
Yeah.
Especially
speaking of somebody who works as an archivist, you know there's a difference.
And
I liked how nervous you got when I said I was doing a save as of our last podcast.
Oh, right. Before we turn this on, and you're saying I'm doing a save, I'm going over what we recorded last time. You sure you want to do that?
Right. Yeah.
And what I meant was I'm just keeping all the settings and putting a new name, and yes, it exists, but you got very nervous.
Yeah.
And it's not even my show.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
One of the things that I think I brought to doing the curation and storytelling for Watching TV in the 1990s is that I'm co-author of a book that I'd like to mention.
Yes.
In great detail, if I may. Watching TV, 8 decades of American television.
So the 90s is covered in this book as well.
Oh, most definitely.
Now, were you doing the book and the exhibit concurrently?
No, actually, they're two totally separate projects. Mm-hmm. The book was done. And the challenge of the Watching TV in the 1990s for the museum is having far fewer words to deal with. That is, you had to make every word count because there was only, I'm holding up my fingers, this much space as opposed to this much space to tell a particular story.
Yeah.
I think I did a rough estimate. There's maybe 50,000 words in Watching TV, the book, about the 90s, and maybe 5,000 words in the exhibit, because we have all these other artifacts and things to go along with the exhibit. So they're different mediums, different ways of experiencing history.
Yeah.
What I'm proud of for Watching TV, the book, is that it follows the same drive that I mentioned before, which is just tell the story. Just explain what was going on. Put it in context. And what Watching TV does, the book, is it's the season-by-season story of television. So each chapter is a season, starting in the mid-1940s.
Okay.
And the way that this is designed is you can open up to any chapter, say, I don't care about the 40s or the 50s. I want to read about the 90s. You can start any chapter because each chapter is self-contained. So it's a narrative of what was going on at that particular time with a particular emphasis and a particular stress of the key stories that were unfolding then. And when I say the stories, I mean what was on TV, some behind-the-scenes machinations, the schedule grids themselves, that is what the fall schedule grid looked like on the broadcast networks, and an ongoing timeline as well. So you could read any chapter you want, get a taste of that era, or if you want to, you could start on page one and read it sequentially.
Yeah.
One of the things that my writing partner, Harry Castleman, and I did in telling this story is we didn't want to cheat. That is, an example I give would be of the quiz show scandal in the 1950s. Now, if you look up quiz show, 1950s, it'll say quiz show, comma, scandal. If you read a lot of online or reference books and went, well, wait, how can it be a scandal if you start out saying it's a scandal?
Right.
No, somebody has to be outraged somewhere. So when we're telling the story starts earlier in the 1950s, when quiz shows were the big deal, when quiz shows were this actually amazing new program format in which real people on live television showed their knowledge, competed with each other, and you were cheering for them, you were rooting for them.
Yeah.
Oh, and you got that question right, and wow, is that impressive. And it was only a couple years later, towards the end of the 1950s, in which, oh, that was play acting. Not always, but in many cases, at least many of the famous shows that you were following, there was, I think there was one person said, there was help offered to some contestants that only an idiot would not follow. So, in other words, the most famous one would be Charles Van Dorn on a program called 21. And if you see the movie Quiz Show.
Yeah, it's Robert Redford.
Director of that. Or if you just go on YouTube and search out 21, just the 21, and watch the contestant, watch the contest in which he finally loses, you have to realize that all of that was staged.
Really?
To be most effective in making this a exciting television offering.
Yeah.
And the context would be that 21 was the first regular show to beat I Love Lucy in its regular time slot.
Really?
For a couple weeks.
Yeah.
And so you could see that the motivation to have the best possible contestant and the most engaging contest play out was what was driving this. And it was, in a way, live reality. Right. Except they were manipulated. And by the way, no one ever broke any law doing that. It was not against the law to have a scripted television show that played as a quiz show.
Right.
The only people that ended up getting tripped up is when they went to, as part of a grand jury investigation, they lied under oath. And so that's where they, yeah. that you can't do. You
right.
can't treat the real world like a little quiz show.
Right. That's incredible.
But anyway, in telling that story, you end up, we told the story over multiple chapters. So if you open up the chapter, which is when quiz shows are first a big hit, that's what you're going to see.
Yeah.
And we're not telling, okay, there's a little hint like, and amazingly, they tied again. Think of that. Two ties in a row,
right.
And then we just leave it at that. But we don't.
But at the time, that would have been people would have been saying,
"Wow,
that.
Wow,
yeah,
that's,
wow,
that's great! What a great contest! I'm watching great television." And so, in watching TV, we do that for every decade, for every year. We go from the beginning, the very beginning of television, which would be pre-television and radio, all the way through to the present.
Yeah.
In fact, I had a chuckle when. If you were following some congressional actions earlier, just about a month ago or so, in which there was a sit-down that was in the halls of Congress, and they turned off the C-SPAN cameras.
Yeah,
yes.
I did. And then all the congressmen were
using
live.
Periscope.
Periscope, yep. Yeah.
And that's one of the things we talk about at the end, where anybody can become a television source.
Yeah.
Now that you have these online tools that you're able to bring to your everyday life.
In the same way that we've created a radio show
with
just a laptop and an internet connection. Yeah.
Because it's all about content.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It really is. It's our conversation, and how we get there is due to your technical skills, your technical expertise, but what's getting there is our conversation.
Yeah.
And that's the important part. And that's why when you go through the book watching TV or you go through our exhibit, that you're looking at the content and you're filtering it through your perspective and you're seeing this is how it all works as part of the television story. And I would like to invite people to participate in the television story by going to museum.tv, because each month we're doing a vote on the best in a particular genre from the 1990s.
Okay.
So in the month of July, it's comedy. Go to museum.tv, and right at the top of the homepage, there's a button that says vote for the top comedies of the 1990s. Go there. You can vote for as many as 9.
Yeah.
We have a prompt list, more than 30 on the prompt list. And then there's a other. You can fill in the blank and put in something. Oh, you didn't have my favorite show. Let me write that in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Somebody said to me, can I put Melrose Place in as my favorite comedy? If that made you laugh and you want to treat it as a comedy, go ahead and do that.
Right.
Well, that's a great point. So since you're orchestrating, what would your vote be?
I have promised not to reveal
nine are.
But I will say the one that I wrote in, because it wasn't one of the choices, because mm-hmm. we had to limit, because I started with a first draft of like 60 or 70s, and no one's going to go through 70 titles to choose even 9. So we got it down to about 2 or 3 dozen. But the one I wrote in was something called Flying Blind. it's a Fox TV show, one season, one season. Taya Leone was a sexy artist, bohemian type in Manhattan.
Yes.
Who illogically, ridiculously, but chemically connected with this young man who I believe is in advertising or some pretty drab, working with his father and all in a regular staid company. And it just opened his eyes out up to a exciting world of Manhattan bohemian life.
Yeah.
And it could not have lasted longer than one season.
Right.
The premise was just too limiting.
Yeah.
That was a period where Taya Leone just had a show every year. They were trying to figure out how to get her to work.
And I thought she was great.
She was great, but she never quite found that vehicle.
And she had something else called The Naked Truth, in which she was like a reporter. That actually hopped between two networks.
Yep.
And we have a magazine cover on display in our artifacts with Taya Leone as the Golden Girl. And they leave something like, will she find the right show? Well, it took from the 90s till now, but she finally did with Madam Secretary.
Mm-hmm.
So that comes back to what you're seeing in the 90s. It's a combination of nostalgia, but it's also recent enough that it's still around.
Yeah.
The players are still around, the themes are still around, and thanks to, of course, online access and reruns and all, there are Seinfeld fans who I know were born after Seinfeld finished,
right,
but have been able to become ardent fans because of the availability of the episodes. And so as you look through the exhibit, you'll see, oh, wait, I know that face, or there's a very young face of someone I'm very familiar with.
Yeah.
Well, this year even, we got a new season of The X-Files after 14
right,
years.
Exactly. And in fact, that came just in time because as I was doing the text write-up about The X-Files, and I made some reference to it returning in the 21st century. So it was... It's part of an ongoing story. There's going to be a Twin Peaks revival, and we've got the Laserdisc box set of Twin Peaks on display. We have the Laserdisc. And the reason that we have these Laserdiscs on display is they're big boxes, and they look really cool.
You can see them from across the gallery.
Yes, exactly, from the Beatles anthology. So we have the discs from that. Yes, it was out on videotape. Yes, it was out on DVD.
Yeah, I have the DVDs.
But the laser disc is just a really nice picture of the set. Coincidentally, the top favorites would probably be, I was sort of looking at how the votes are going right now, so I'm encouraging people to come in and cast your votes.
Yeah.
The ones that you think are going to get the most votes probably are getting the most votes.
Yeah, I assume Seinfeld, The Simpsons are winning for comedy shows.
But that's one of the reasons that we have you can vote for nine. So that lets you get a little bit off the wall. And that's why I mentioned The Flying Blind. Because, obviously, I know there's no way that's going to get more than one vote.
Right.
Yeah.
Unless people inspired say, oh, yeah, that was one of my favorites. Let me vote for that.
I would like to see how something like News Radio or The Norma Show does.
Sure. Yeah, News Radio, that's a great show. Yeah.
And so as you go a little farther down the list, then that's where you're, if I have nine to vote for, okay, let me fill all of those in. And then next month we're going to do drama, and then we're going to do children's shows, and we're going to do talk shows because that's going to tie it more in with political coverage and such. And then at the end we're going to then have people vote for one and one only to get the best of the best. In these categories. But... please come in, and so you don't even have to be in Chicago. You can go online, take a look at that, and that might inspire you to come on downtown. And the Museum of Broadcast Communication is in downtown Chicago. If you're from this area, it's near Marina City or right around the corner from Harry Carey's. It depends on what your tourist orientation
right,
is.
Right, right.
It's actually like very close to the Marina Towers, which were a big part of the Bob Newhart show.
Yes.
So if you're interested in television...
Oh, we're in a great location.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about the 90s in terms of style, and you mentioned a few times how self-indulgence was kind of the key. I've always been fascinated, and I believe we talked about this a little bit on our Star Trek panel when we were at DePaul, of the kind of self-conscious darkness of the 90s. Mm-hmm. It always seemed to me that we were in a period, pre-9/11, that we felt pretty safe, so it seemed like we kept pushing our television to get darker. Things like The X-Files, a perfect example. Deep Space Nine is probably the darkest of all the Star Treks. Batman the Animated Series.
Yeah, I was going to say, for a kid show, that was pretty dark.
Still to this day, pretty dark. So I was always wondering, and there's Buffy the Vampire Slayer is another big thing. There's a lot more horror. So I'm wondering, going through the exhibit and writing the book, is that a symptom of the self-indulgence, or is there something else at work?
I think it was actually a reflection of that self-confidence. Mm. You wanted to not just go to the edge, you wanted to step off. You wanted to go someplace you had never been before. I mean, if you think about how Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David approached comedy, they're saying, okay, what can't you do? Let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the sense of the storytelling, in the darker reaches of the X-Files and the darker reaches of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you're saying, I want to go there. I want to see where this takes me. I'm talking about as a viewer.
Yeah.
And then as a writer and as a producer, they're going to let me do this? Okay, let's do it. And I think that was a good matching of audience that was ready for something a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
The opening of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the series, I didn't see the first episode when it aired sequentially, but I saw it within maybe 3 months.
Okay.
And what's most striking is it starts out reversing every cliche you can come up with about the vampire sagas.
Yeah.
Starting with they're in the dark. They're in the high school after hours. Everything is dark, and there's these noises. Is there something? And it's a young girl and a young man who are going to be making out or whatever. Pardon me for using the 50s terminology. And so you figure, okay, the expectation is he's going to turn around and he's going to be the evil vampire, or there's going to be some wolf creature come through the door. No, she's the vampire. She turns around and she drains his blood. And it's like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then to reverse decades of vampire tales, the pretty blonde title character is not the damsel in distress, is not the one to be rescued. She is the one doing the rescuing.
Yeah.
And it was probably no coincidence that among female academics, this is a much treasured series, mm-hmm. because it was a great assertion of female power. And Buffy wasn't the only character who was that strong.
Right.
Only female character who was that strong. And consistently across the board, you had this, whatever your expectations were, we're gonna twist them. And it followed celebration of gay love.
Mm-hmm.
It followed the forbidden lure of sex. There's a character in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, and basically there's the first time that they have sex together, invokes, triggers a curse, and he was a good vampire, now he becomes evil. But you could also translate that into, see, what did mom say?
Right.
You have sex
with a vampire.
Or this boy that you think is good, and they just turn evil. They just turn evil.
Yeah.
And so it was a reverse on a reverse on a reverse. And to save the world, Buffy has to kill him. For the first time, he comes back for his own series.
Sure,
and all.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of there being edges that you can't leap off of instead became, these are edges we want to leap off of. And that's what makes television in the 90s so exciting to review.
Yeah.
To see, wow, they were doing things that I was not expecting. And by the way, they could also do the absolute mainstream. I mean, nothing could be more mainstream than something like Home Improvement.
Right.
Or Everybody Loves Raymond. And they pulled those off superbly. And in fact, let me sort of bookend this with Dick Wolf, who did the Law and Order was in 1990. In 1999, he gets the, after almost a decade of success, does Law and Order Special Victims Unit. Basically saying, here's a style of storytelling which has been very successful for me. Now, let's do a little twist on it, but basically tell the same story of different characters, different things, because there are so many of these self-contained stories we can share. And he ends the decade basically demonstrating that this could be a franchise.
Yeah.
And it was the first of many Law and Orders that would then follow. And so you had these, let's push past our normal expectations, that have come from years decades of watching television in some cases. Let's do something different. Or let's take some of the core storytelling elements. And Law and Order basically said, cop show, lawyer show, put them together and follow the story from beginning to end. Let's do that. And he had tremendous success with that formula. Both of them coexisted because there was enough bandwidth, so to speak, in the commercial world that could still support all of those. Now, when you have 500 shows, it becomes a different challenge.
Right.
It's interesting when you said how Dick Wolf closed the 90s. It made me think, what would you say, now I'm not asking you to give your votes, but what would you say is the show that begins the 90s for you, and what's the show that ends the 90s or creates the 2000s?
Ooh. Because you've actually asked three questions. Begins the 90s, much as I love Seinfeld, I would have to say The Simpsons. I mean, The Simpsons comes around and says, we're going to do anything we want. We're going to start with the premise of these characters never age. And we're going to take these stories wherever we want to go. And we're going to do that with media savvy, confidence, and a style that still astonishes me. When I tune in a Simpsons episode, the first 10 minutes would be a 30-minute episode for anybody else.
Yeah.
And now they say, oh, and by the way, let's go here with that story.
Right.
And so The Simpsons, I think, showed that in the 90s, anything could happen.
Right. The Simpsons was also important for it breaks the sitcom rule of having 6-7 characters because those are your actors, and they're like, we'll do 50. We'll use the same 6-7 people to do them,
right.
But we'll have an entire town of people.
You hire the best voice
and
actors in Hollywood.
As long as The Simpsons are somewhat involved, we can do an Apu story. We can do a Mr. Burns story. We can do a Krusty story. And on something like Friends, you have 6 actors who are on screen all the time. The story's going to be about one of them.
Yeah.
If not, subplots that are a few of them.
Yeah.
I also love the repercussions you see in The Simpsons in animation. We were talking briefly about things like Animaniacs and Pinky and the Brain, and it raised the level of writing in animation. It seemed like everyone in animation looked to The Simpsons and said, oh, we could do that now? And Saturday morning cartoons got so smart in the 90s. It seemed like they were all kind of trying to chase that goal.
Yeah.
And that was good.
Oh, yeah.
So in terms of a defining series, it would be The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. If you're going to do a drama, for the 90s, I would say the Law & Order franchise basically said, this is how you can do television, and this is how we will do television in the future. And you see Dick Wolf doing the same thing with his Chicago Fire, Chicago PD, Chicago Med currently. That is, you can do this. You can, and in fact, what he's done with the Chicago, and he did this with the Law & Order, is they're in the same world.
They're all connected. Mm-hmm.
They're
yeah.
all in the same world, and that's what viewers have always assumed when they've watched TV and can never figure out why these characters never run into each
right,
other.
Right,
and it's what we talk about the Marvel films.
Well,
now.
The Marvel films, but more in the context of like the Marvel comics back in the day when Stan Lee first started creating is, Spider-Man had run into the Fantastic Four, and the Avengers are over here. And it's like
because one guy was writing all of them,
right? And that's it's kind of like I've always kind of wanted that subconsciously out of TV and movies, and now we're getting that. And it's like it's just took the machine, the wheels behind the machine, to kind of catch up to it.
About half a century.
Yeah, you know, better late than never. You know, we're living in a good time.
And I'm sort of dancing past a couple of other very important dramas. The Sopranos would be in the same way that The Simpsons said, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people who saw what The Sopranos pulled off, this is right at the end of the 90s, 1999, so you're talking about pointing to the next century. But it's like, oh, they did that. Okay, I want to do that too. And so you have the likes of, say, a Breaking Bad saying, this is a thoroughly detestable character who's the hero, and you're with him all the way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
Something like Mad Men, which comes from Matthew Weiner, who wrote on The Sopranos.
And that's being a little more positive.
Yeah.
He's not a killer.
Right.
Although the first couple of seasons, my wife always would get edgy because it was built on that same engine in the same way that Breaking Bad was built on the X-Files engine because that's where that person came from. So Mad Men had a pace that was like mm-hmm. Sopranos. So when things got really quiet, my wife always believed someone was going to be murdered.
Right. they all work in desks and advertising.
A couple of people died on the show, but I don't remember anyone ever being murdered.
Right, it's a little different.
But that gets back to the heart both of the watching TV book and of the watching TV in the 1990s exhibit, is that looking at where we've been and enjoying where we've been helps us to better appreciate where we are now. So I'm going to do a summary of websites. Go to museum.tv, museum.tv while you're there. Go to the little button and go over your favorite watchingtv.org, and you could read all about the Watching TV book, or frankly, go to Amazon, type in Watching TV, and you can order a copy, or buy it at the bookstore here at the museum. But when you go to the watchingtv.org, I urge you to look at the stories behind the titles of the chapters, because those are fun. We explain the different allusions. Sometimes they're song titles, sometimes they're quotes, sometimes they're just wordplay. And that's a 5,000-word excursion into our writing right there, because each of the 75 chapters has a little bit of an explanation.
That's awesome.
If you want to follow me, I am at Not On My Book on Twitter. You can follow the show on Facebook, Caffeinated Comics. You can also listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can listen to the entire archive of our over 200 interviews on caffeinatedcomics.blogspot.com.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not On My Book production.
Take that, meatball!